It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. On the show today, ideas about how to approach life and deal with its zigs and zags. Should you plan, improvise, or pivot? Back in 2008, Sonia Vallab was in her 20s.
I was living right here in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
She was a newlywed.
Eric, my husband, and I had moved here to go to grad school. He got a joint degree in transportation engineering and city planning.
And Sonia was going to law school at Harvard.
And we thought that, you know, that was sort of the path that we were on. Those were the careers we were going to have. And it was in my second year of law school, which was 2010, that unbeknownst to me was sort of the beginning of a huge sort of chapter break in our lives.
This very strange story starts with Sonia's mom, who at the time was 51 years old and up until then had been perfectly healthy.
And then all of a sudden was almost in complete free fall, losing her abilities one by one by one, and nobody knew why. The very first things that showed up were that she lost a lot of weight, no explanation, and her eyesight started to play tricks on her. Neither of these things seemed like either an emergency or like they were connected to each other or to something larger.
Uh-huh.
But then, like, very rapidly, we were in a situation where she was getting confused. She was having a hard time putting sentences together. She was having a hard time remembering to do things or where she had put things or who she was talking to. And nobody went to neurodegenerative disease right at first. The possibilities that were thrown out were very, very far flung. She was tested for tons of things. And it just felt like the fabric of reality was like tearing apart. It just felt wrong and bizarre.
So what happened? You kept going to law school and spending time with her as much as you could? Or how did things progress?
Basically, yes. I went home when I could. And, you know, it was only, she had those very first symptoms in February. She was, like, completely confused in March. She was too weak to walk in May. She went into the hospital basically full-time in June. And after that, the degree to which it was possible to communicate with her fell off super dramatically. We still didn't have a diagnosis. And the longer this went on, the more I realized that I no longer believed she could recover. And I remember specifically in the fall of that year, I went for a walk in a park near my home where I grew up, and the fall colors were, you know, in full splendor. And I was walking by myself, and I realized that I had already said goodbye to my mom. That she was in so much pain. She was in a place that was so far away from us. It just seemed insurmountable. It just seemed like too much.
Sonia Vallab picks up her story from the TED stage.
By the time she dies, it has been months since she was really there. And we still have no idea what happened. And then we get the results of my mom's autopsy. The report tells us that my mom died of genetic prion disease. And that I am at 50-50 risk of having inherited the single letter DNA typo that caused it. Prion disease spreads through your brain and kills your neurons. And it kills about 1 in 6,000 people. But most cases aren't genetic, they're random. So it's maybe 1 in 50,000 people that has a high-risk mutation like this one. I stand at this fork in the road with Eric, and sometimes in life you know yourself. We realize there is no fork. We want to know. I'm trained as a lawyer. He's trained as a transportation engineer. We are not biomedical people, but we know that for us, this limbo isn't life. I can't control what happens next, but I can control whether something happens next. And my choice is Yes. So I get tested, and we learn that I have the mutation. What does this mean for me, for us? Genetic prion disease is always fatal. We can't say when it will strike, only that it'll be some point in adulthood, and once it does, you die in months. We have just watched it happen.
One of the things that happens after a genetic test is you get genetic counseling and you get recommendations for how to go on with living your life. What did they tell you?
Well, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus here, but because you asked, I'll tell you that before my test report was given to me, the genetic counselor said, no matter what the result, we're going to sit down together and we're going to make a plan for your health and wellness, what you eat or like whatever. And then the result was given to me. And then the medical professionals in the room said, you probably want some time, and left me and my husband sitting there and didn't come back. And in retrospect, that kind of captures it. There was nothing to say. There's no plan. Like, eating blueberries isn't going to help. There's no drug. I knew all this before I got tested. So it was just kind of, in some ways, a very fitting close to the appointment.
So you and your husband are sitting in this empty room looking at each other. What did you say to one another?
He cried and I held him. We had two friends who were sitting in the waiting room, and my dad flew in the next day, and the five of us kind of spent the weekend together just grieving, but also just doing normal things. And what I managed to get sort of front of mind during that weekend was the idea that I was basically no more likely to die that day or that week than I had been. In fact, nothing had changed at all, right? Like, this mutation had always been in my body.
Uh-huh.
That established a little bit of a protective bubble where I could do the things that were involved in, like, living. And it was just a few weeks in that a friend of ours came over and he brought a bunch of scientific articles on a thumb drive. And he said, you guys should read these. There are people working on this whose day-to-day is thinking about this disease, what causes it, what goes wrong, potentially even how can we stop it. And that was like a mesmerizing thought.
Yeah. What did it make you and Eric think?
I mean, at first, it just made me think I need to take a sabbatical. I need to get up to speed on this new thing that has come crashing into our lives. And then I'll go back to my regularly scheduled life.
But that is not what happened, because from there, things got a little weird. First, she enrolled in some night classes just to learn more about biology.
That itself, then, sort of without me having totally planned or foreseen it, led to a next thing.
She ended up getting a job as an entry-level research assistant in a lab.
And that was the beginning. I mean, I worked in that lab for 2 years.
Eric, her husband, did something similar. He got a job in a bioinformatics lab.
I could feel that there was like a momentum pulling us in this direction, and now here we were doing low on the totem pole science jobs, being able to make a living from it. And we sort of looked at each other and said, huh, if we can actually work in this field, don't we have to be thinking about how we move towards doing exactly the work that we think needs to be done and developing a drug for prion disease?
So, 2 years after leaving their professions, both Sonia and Eric went for PhDs in biological and biomedical sciences at Harvard.
We spent 5 years as PhD students, and we defended in 2019 and sort of rolled forward our own lab here at the Broad Institute, which is now 14 people.
I mean, it's kind of wild. You and Eric are now leading a lab that is looking for a therapy for prion disease. But, like, at the time, did people think you had lost it? How did people around you respond to this big change that you all made?
I'm sure there were people who thought that we were way out of our depth. They would not have been wrong. Certainly, it wasn't easy. And this is something I've really come to appreciate about science, is that there's no bottom to how complex it can be. It's under no obligation to be knowable in your lifetime. Like, it's just, it's constantly moving under your feet. But even if it stood still, it would be, like, unmappably vast.
Mm.
But I think that there was a spirit of optimism. We're going to throw ourselves at this problem because it is a worthy problem. And we will move the ball down the field by being totally focused and dedicated to this problem.
Let's talk about how prion disease works and what we need to do about it. Prion disease is unique in all of biology. The causal pathogen isn't a virus, and it's not a bacterium. It's this one normal protein called PRP that you normally have in your body, and it's normally not a problem, but it is capable of going rogue. And then it goes around grabbing other copies of PRP, and it corrupts those. And if we think about how to treat this disease, we might think, go get those bad guys. Pew, pew. But Eric and I have come to see our mission differently. What if we can do the most good, not by going after the big, scary pathogens and lobbing fireballs at them? What if what we really need to do is this? Long before disease begins, we use a drug to ask this not yet pathogenic protein to please go away. We're lucky to have the series of clues from nature that indicate you can live a healthy life without PRP. So we're scouring the globe for tools to dial it down. Our greatest good isn't a drug that will stabilize me or anyone else mid-train wreck, 1 foot in the void. We have to aim higher. We have to prevent. And maybe you're wondering how it's all going. Here's what I can say. There will be the race to the first drug and the race to the best drug. We're far from the end of this quest, but we're far from the beginning. We don't have any guarantees. Darn. But what we do have, and gosh, are we lucky to have it, is jeopardy.
I hate this question, but I have to ask it. Do you feel like you're racing against the clock? I mean, how old are you now?
I'm 40.
You're 40. So are you thinking, like, I gotta figure this out in the next decade before I get to be my mom's age?
I mean, the interesting thing about genetic prion disease is that age of onset is not predictable.
Oh.
It could happen anytime. So I don't presume that we have a specific number of years to get this done. Regardless of what we thought for me, even if we did believe that my mom's age of onset predicted my age of onset, there's people for whom we already haven't been on time. Lots of them. Every week we hear from more of them. So it is a matter of getting there as quickly as we can.
I got dealt a bad card, and don't get me wrong, I really don't want to die young. At the same time, this bad card has launched me on a quest with a team. And the wonder of this exact life is that I am constantly getting to meet people's best selves, including versions of Eric and me, that I wouldn't have encountered any other way. Does everything happen for a reason? Probably not. And yet, here we all are, making our own grace out of the darndest raw materials. It is not such a bad thing to be called to notice. Speaking of grace, I want you to meet these guys. These are our kids. Daruka is the big one. Kavari is the also big one. We had them through IVF with pre-implantation genetic testing to avoid passing on my mutation. My mom never got to meet these kids, and she would have been a luminous grandma. But if she had, we wouldn't have known about my risk in time to avoid passing it on. So somewhere wrapped up in the grief of having lost her so young is this other thing, this transgenerational gift. I'm walking alongside these kids on their own journeys as best I can. And you know how it is with kids. Sometimes the shape of the future begs to be assumed. X number of years until Y, this parade of milestones, this storyboard. But here again is a luxury not all of us have. And perhaps, in ways large and small, it's a luxury none of us have.
They're 7 and 4. They know what we do for a living and why.
They do.
You know, they've always known. They've always known that we're scientists, that we work on the disease that killed my mom, that I'm at risk, that we do this because we want to develop a medicine so that nobody has to die that way anymore. I just want this to be part of their normal. And I wouldn't have it any other way because this, even at these ages, shows them, I think, that you can love what you do, even if it's hard, that you can like choose a worthy problem and give yourself to it and still have a good life. I think it's an important part of knowing who we are.
Well, that's what I keep thinking about is I can imagine, or actually I've told people this story. I'm like, and then she found out she had the disease and they made this crazy life change. And some people are like, wow, that's real optimism to think that you can figure this out. Other people are like, that's real hubris to think that you can figure it out. But regardless, it's strong-headedness either way. What reaction do you get?
People tell me how inspiring they think what we're doing is. And that's very, very kind. But I worry that sometimes people say it in the spirit of like, oh my God, like you, Sonia Vallab, had this like really specific and incredible reaction. And I think that's like the wrong story. I actually think that we collectively might not know what we're made of until the moment when we have to know. And I would not have known. I never could have predicted that this is what I would do.
Yeah.
You don't know until you have to know. And there's sort of this like bending upward of the human spirit through hardship that my word for it is grace. Maybe there are other and better words, but now when I look for it, I see it everywhere. And that's not to be Pollyanna-ish and say, this is all going to work out. Because I don't know, man. So to the people who say it's hubris, I have no assumptions about us succeeding. But I'm really, really happy to be doing our best.
That's Sonia Vallab. She's a senior biomedical researcher at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. You can see her full talk at TED.com. On the show today, ideas about how to live your life. Should you improvise, plan, or pivot? I'm Manoush Zomorodi. Stay with us.